everyone, and welcome to the second full-length episode of Nebby, the podcast about Pittsburgh's history, mysteries, myths, and misanthropes. I'm April Johnston, your researcher, writer, producer, and host. Thanks to everyone who listened to the first episode about the crashed B-25 bomber, and the special mini-episode about Amelia Earhart. We are now done with plane crashes, and we're moving on to a story about a man who was instrumental in shaping Pittsburgh's sports and culture. If you're the type whose history lessons ended when you shut your high school textbooks, you may not know much about this person, but you absolutely should. This story isn't about Ray Spiegel, but I'm going to start with him. Spiegel was a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the Post-Gazette, probably best known for a series proving that a newly appointed Supreme Court justice was a member of the KKK. But before that prize-winning investigative work, Spiegel penned a fascinating six-part series on a phenomenon just taking root in the city, the numbers game. Part one of the series takes place in 1926 in Pittsburgh's Morals Court, where a police inspector and a city magistrate try to decide what charges are warranted in their latest case. Here are Spiegel's first few paragraphs. Beside the magistrate are two men, one a giant, with great bulging shoulders that threatened to burst the seams of his coat. The other, of average size, but dwarfed by his towering companion. "I don't know what charge to put against these fellows," the inspector tells the magistrate. "It's a new one on me." "Well, what do they do?" the magistrate wants to know. "It's some kind of new racket they're pulling among the people up on the hill. They sell these little slips with numbers on them, for anything from a cent up. Then somehow or other, the clearinghouse totals for Pittsburgh District enter into it. If the fellow who bought the slip wins, he gets $7.50 for every cent he plays. The whole Hill District is going crazy over it. It ain't operating a gambling house, but it's gambling all right. I don't know what you'd call it." So the inspector and the magistrate drag out a dog-eared and well-thumbed copy of the revised statutes that does duty as a book of rules for the Morals Court. That doesn't help much. So they call the city legal department and get one of the assistant city solicitors on the telephone. They take turns trying to explain to him this new racket that has hit Pittsburgh, hampered by the fact that neither one of them knows just what it's all about. "Well, sounds like a lottery to me," the assistant city solicitor decides. "Charge them with operating a lottery." It's a $50 fine, but neither one of the men has $50. So they're taken back to their cells, where one of them places a call to the Hill District. Within a few minutes, the fines are paid, and the men are headed back to the Hill to write more slips. That lottery, as the assistant city solicitor called it, would go on to make the two men millionaires. And one of those millionaires, the one with the great bulging shoulders, would use that money to fund the legendary jazz club, the Crawford Grill, and one of the greatest baseball teams ever to take the field, the Pittsburgh Crawfords. That man was Gus Greenlee. William Augustus Greenlee was born the day after Christmas, 1895, in Marion County, North Carolina, to perhaps the most prominent black family in town. His father, Samuel, was a masonry contractor. His mother, Julia, the daughter of a white businessman, and responsible for passing along the genes that gave Greenlee his distinctive plait of red hair. Samuel and Julia expected their 7 children to attend college, and Greenlee's brothers did as they were instructed, becoming doctors and lawyers. But Gus Greenlee was never one to follow a well-worn path. He dropped out of school after just a year and hopped a freight train headed north. It was 1916, making him part of the country's Great Migration and one of thousands of black men headed to the urban north to find work. Pittsburgh seemed like a good place to stop. The belching black smoke of the steel mills beckoned those who longed for some stability and a decent paycheck. For a while, Greenlee labored in those mills. He also took jobs shining shoes and driving cabs. But when the United States entered World War I, so did he. Greenlee was a machine gunner in the famed 367th Regiment, which fought in France and earned numerous commendations for valor. His time as a soldier ended abruptly in 1919 when he took shrapnel to the leg. And soon, he was back in Pittsburgh, driving cabs. Only this time around, Greenlee wasn't just transporting people. This was Prohibition-era Pittsburgh, and there was money to be made in bootlegging. So Greenlee filled gas cans with liquor and sold them out of the trunk of his cab, earning him the first of his many monikers, Gasoline Gus. Bootlegging proved a good way to make quick cash, but it was not the kind of job that earned the wealth and prestige for which Greenlee would become known. That came from the numbers. Numbers running wasn't unique to Pittsburgh. Nearly every big city in the country had a game going at that time. But it was unique in Pittsburgh. Because instead of a single game run by one organization, Pittsburgh's polls were, not surprisingly, carved by the rivers. The North Side had a poll, the East End another, Bloomfield ran a big one, and then there was the Hill District poll, operated by Greenlee and William Woogie Harris, Greenlee's co-defendant in the story that topped the podcast. Here's how the numbers game worked. Greenlee and Harris employed a stable of people who each got a cut of the day's take. Writers, those are the people who interacted with the customers, collecting the money and writing the slips, got 60%. The pickup men who delivered the money to headquarters got 5%. Greenlee and Harris got the rest. And if your number hit, well, you got $7.50 for every penny you put in. But the thing is, hardly anybody hit. The man or woman who actually won money on the numbers in those days probably never realized how lucky he or she was, Spriegel wrote in his Post-Gazette series. They were lucky to hit, but they were a whole lot luckier to collect. And Gus and Woogie's poll is the only one that has never folded up and has never welched. They pay. That became exceedingly clear on August 5th, 1930, the day of the infamous hunch number, when seemingly the entire city played 8:05 in honor of the day's date. And it hit. Numbers runners were known to take in $25,000 a day. A lot of money, even by today's standards. But when you begin multiplying the number of hits by the amount of money played on August 5th, it quickly became clear. That hit was a catastrophe. While other numbers runners in other neighborhoods folded up and fled town, or, in the case of the North Side, paid just half, Greenlee and Harris paid every hit to every player. It wasn't easy. They had to mortgage their houses and sell their cars to do it. But everyone in the city knew it, and suddenly, they all wanted in. steelworkers and housewives, black and white, north side and south, the Hill District game became the game to play. And that meant even more money. By 1930, Greenlee had already established himself as the foremost businessman in the Hill. In addition to running numbers, he owned several businesses, including the Sunset Cafe, the Working Man's Pool Hall, and the Paramount Club, which the Pittsburgh Courier once called just about the classiest beer garden and nightclub the city has ever enjoyed. Greenlee wasn't the only person to benefit from the success. He took the entire Hill District with him. If you weren't on his payroll, and most people were, you were likely on his long list of beneficiaries. It didn't matter what you needed. A job, money for rent, a business loan, college tuition. If you asked, Greenlee delivered. His philanthropy was a workaround, a way to beat the system of segregation that permeated the city. And it came with a useful upshot. It insulated him from the law. Numbers running, though certainly illegal, wasn't really viewed as immoral. As Gus's brother George once put it, "We're just giving some work to some of the boys." Most neighborhood police officers looked the other way when writers took to the streets early in the morning with their slips. Some even played themselves. When arrests did come, they were typically the result of organized raids, which relied on scanty evidence that lawyers easily explained away, or on the testimony of lower-level employees, which almost always backfired. Because no one wanted to rat out his boss. If Greenlee got convicted, the whole operation folded with him. Upon his arrest during a raid, one Greenlee employee admitted to working for the Numbers King, but on the stand months later, testified that the Greenlee in the courtroom wasn't the Greenlee he worked for. That Greenlee was a white guy. This kind of embarrassment happened enough that Greenlee took some pleasure in it. More than once, he strolled down to the local police station, planted an elbow on the counter, and said, "I heard you boys been looking for me." It's not hard to imagine the police holding a kind of begrudging admiration for Greenlee. He was impressive, standing 6'3" tall and weighing in north of 230 pounds. He traveled in a chauffeured Lincoln convertible and usually held a cigar between his teeth. His campaign contributions bought the loyalty of local politicians, who called him Mr. Big. And even when, maybe especially when cornered, he adopted a disarming calm. After police found slot machines in a locked back room in one of Greenlee's clubs, and Greenlee insisted they weren't his, a skeptical magistrate who caught the hearing insisted on investigating the matter further. He ordered Greenlee to return to the courtroom the next day. Greenlee said he couldn't. He was booked, headed to New York that night, Chicago the next, and London shortly after that. "Well, when I want you, I'll call you, or you call me in the next few days," the flustered magistrate replied. Greenlee's already outsized reputation only swelled when he opened the Crawford Grill on New Year's Eve, 1933. The jazz club was as big and extravagant as the man who owned it, rising for 3 stories and covering nearly a city block on Wiley Avenue in the Hill. It boasted Spanish frescoes, a rotating stage, a glass-topped bar, and a mirrored upright piano. The Courier called it ultra-ultra style. Though it was classified as a jazz club, and many of the era's greats took to its stage, including Lena Horne and Dizzy Gillespie, the Crawford Grill was really a social club, a place to be seen. Art Rooney dined there, Billy Strayhorn and Duke Ellington were first introduced there, and Satchel Paige met his wife there. In fact, it was so beloved by Pittsburgh Crawford's players that they referred to it as third base, the last stop before home. Though the action took place on the first two floors, Greenlee spent his time on the third floor, which everyone called Club Crawford. The photos of Greenlee taken there, surely in one shot by Teenie Harris, are of a man fond of three-piece suits, tightly knotted ties, and good cigars. He is nearly always surrounded by a group of smiling men wearing fedoras and top coats. Club Crawford may have catered to the elite, but true to the neighborhood that held it, the rest of the Crawford Grill was a place for everyone, young and old, rich and poor, and perhaps most significant at the time, black and white. That it was situated in Pittsburgh's Hill District and not New York or Chicago was no mistake. The Hill had always been a melting pot, populated, abandoned, and then populated again by migrants of every ethnicity. Irish, Germans, Italians, Jews, Russians, Polacks, Slovaks, Armenians, Syrians, and, beginning at the turn of the 20th century, African Americans. A journalist once dubbed it the crossroads of the world, and the name stuck. As ethnomusicologist Coulter Harper wrote in his study of the neighborhood, from the 1910s, the Hill was recognized as a place where revelers flocked for new experiences. It became a place where the local and the national intersected, where ideas and artistic practices were exchanged and developed, and where an African American community could, to some extent, operate on its own terms. Greenlee reveled in the subversiveness of it all and welcomed the attention that came with it, even when that attention wasn't exactly affectionate. The black community in Pittsburgh at that time often divided itself into two camps. Those who had been born and raised in the Steel City were known as original Pittsburghers, or OPs. They had deep ties to their families and their communities. Those, like Greenlee, who had grown up in the South and come north for work, were regarded by the OPs as mischief makers, responsible for the Hill's seedy underbelly of bootlegging and prostitution. Of course, it wasn't that simple. Plenty of OPs wrote number slips and delivered bootlegged liquor, and plenty of native Southerners had developed a loyalty to the city. But Greenlee wasn't afraid to play to type. And so, when he was presented the opportunity to buy the Pittsburgh Crawfords, the crosstown rivals of the Homestead Grays, owned by quintessential original Pittsburgher Cumberland Posey, Greenlee took it. And despite knowing little about the game, he built himself what many consider the best team in baseball history. Professional black baseball endured a lot of fits and starts before Greenlee became involved. The League of Colored Baseball Clubs launched in 1887, but disbanded after just a week. The Cuban Giants joined the mostly white Middle States League in 1888, but by 1890, decided they were better off returning to their barnstorming roots. The Integrated International League of Independent Professional Baseball Clubs managed to last a full year in 1906. But the first direct line to what we know collectively as the Negro Leagues was the Negro National League, which took off in 1920 and featured eight teams, including the storied Kansas City Monarchs. Within a decade, the founder of the Negro National League and his successor, committed themselves to mental institutions, reportedly due to the stress of running the league. That, combined with the depression, might have spelled the end of black professional baseball in America, had it not been for Come Posey. Posey did two things right. First, in 1932, the owner of the Homestead Grays pumped his considerable wealth into an 8-team East-West league. Second, though Posey's league folded within the year, in that time, he managed to so irritate Gus Greenlee that Greenlee started his own damn league. Greenlee purchased the Pittsburgh Crawfords Club in 1930, and taking a page from the Come Posey playbook, immediately began poaching the top players from rival teams. The first star to arrive was Satchel Paige. Lured not by the money, which was just $250 a week, but by the opportunity to have a team built around his considerable talent and ego. And it didn't hurt that Greenlee threw in money for good suits and VIP status at the Crawford Grill. Paige occupied the stool right next to Greenlee, up in Club Crawford. Defensive specialist John Henry Russell, third baseman Judy Johnson, and speedster Cool Papa Bell, who I think you'll agree has the greatest nickname in sports, they came next. Then perhaps to stick it to Posey, who wouldn't let Greenlee join that East-West league, or perhaps simply because Posey had the best players, Greenlee picked off the heart of the Grays lineup. Pitcher-catcher double-duty Radcliffe, player-manager Oscar Charleston, and the great Josh Gibson. Five of those players, Bell, Charleston, Gibson, Page, and Johnson, would eventually enter the Baseball Hall of Fame. And they anchored the 1935 Crawfords that won the National Negro League Championship and is widely considered the best baseball team ever, black or white. Losing such talent did not make Posey happy. Posey was the antithesis of Greenlee, college educated and Pittsburgh born. His father not only owned Diamond Coke and Coal, the largest black-owned company in the city, but served as the first president of the Pittsburgh Courier, one of the country's premier black newspapers. Despite their heated rivalry and their obvious differences, Posey couldn't deny Greenlee was good for baseball. The Negro Leagues needed a character, a force, to lead them. Greenlee was both. One of his best traits was the refusal to accept the status quo. In 1931, Greenlee decided that playing on ramshackle fields, or even worse, playing on major league fields but being barred from using the clubhouse, that would no longer do. He commissioned a majestic $100,000 stadium in the Hill District, designed by a black architect and built by black construction workers, mostly on Greenlee's dime. On opening day, it was Greenlee who walked across the field and threw out the first pitch, while wearing a white silk suit. Riding that high, Greenlee decided it was time to make a power grab. Shortly after Posey's East-West League tanked, Greenlee established his own Negro National League and installed himself as the chairman. Though he almost certainly didn't want to, left with no other choice, Posey sought admittance. Greenlee agreed, then immediately suspended him for poaching players. I like to think Greenlee saw the irony. He just didn't care. Greenlee's 6 years at the helm of the Negro National League were, not unexpectedly, a bit tumultuous. He instituted an all-star game that would become the showpiece of the league, but he also imposed an unpopular salary cap and refused to guarantee visiting teams a percentage of the gate. It wasn't Greenlee's only trouble. In 1937, the Dominican Republic lured several of the Crawfords' key players to the Caribbean with promises of larger salaries. In 1938, the city seized Greenlee Field in the name of urban redevelopment and demolished it. And then there was the John Henry Lewis problem. Greenlee had been managing the light heavyweight boxing champ for years. Lewis trained out of Greenlee's house in Penn Township and was considered part of the family. Some say the closest childless Greenlee got to having a son. Each night before Lewis left, he took a seat at the living room piano and played a few songs for Greenlee. The better Lewis fought, the more attention Greenlee paid him. And with so many business ventures, something had to give a little. It ended up being baseball. True to his nature, Greenlee took a gamble. If he could find a way to have his Lewis fight heavyweight champ Joe Lewis, it would bring him more fame and wealth than the Crawfords ever could. In 1938, Greenlee came achingly close to making that happen. He set up a fight between John Henry Lewis and Tony Galento, the number one challenger for Joe Lewis's title. If John Henry Lewis could get past Galento, and there were plenty of people who thought he could, the fight Greenlee dreamed of was as good as scheduled. But Lewis never fought Galento. On the night of the fight, Galento came down with pneumonia. "Worst break I ever got," Greenlee famously said. The Lewises did eventually fight, but it was more than a year later, and John Henry was already suffering the partial blindness that would end his career. Joe Lewis beat him easily. At that point, Negro League owners smelled blood. They wanted Greenlee out, and this was their chance. Greenlee acquiesced, resigning as chair of the Negro National League in the fall of 1939. That spring, he disbanded the Crawfords. Such a string of public defeats may have broken another man, but this was Gus Greenlee, Mr. Big. He didn't embarrass easily. Greenlee spent several years nursing his finances back to health, surely with the help of the Crawford Grill, but probably not the numbers game, which he claimed to have abandoned in the mid-1930s. With a little time on his hands, and because Greenlee was, as a Post-Gazette sports editor once wrote, not one to look a gift horse in the teeth, especially when the gift horse might give an old rival a kick in the pants, Greenlee spent a bit of time agitating Negro League owners. He began urging players to demand their own piece of the lucrative East-West All-Star Game take, and they eventually held out for $200 apiece. No matter that it was Greenlee who first established that game, and its policy not to reward players. While the owners cursed Greenlee's meddling, Greenlee turned his attention to another baseball venture. In 1945, he established the United States League. National headquarters? Club Crawford. It lasted only about 2 years, but it played a significant role in baseball and American history. Greenlee's United States League had the backing of Dodgers general manager Branch Rickey, who needed a cover to scout for the perfect players to break baseball's Keller barrier. In May 1945, Rickey signed Jackie Robinson. With that, the Negro Leagues that Greenlee had nursed into a national gem faded into history. when numbers running was good, and when it wasn't. When he owned the Pittsburgh Crawfords, and when he didn't. When the police came looking for him, and when they looked the other way. Through it all, the constant in Gus Greenlee's life was the Crawford Grill. On July 8th, 1951, a four-alarm fire broke out at the grill. The blaze spread over all three floors, consuming the kitchen, the stage, and Club Crawford, leaving nothing behind but a blackened shell. Almost exactly 1 year later, July 7th, 1952, after spending several months in the VA hospital, Gus Greenlee died, likely of a stroke. He left his wife Helen, two sisters, two brothers, and a city of admirers to mourn him. The next day, the Pittsburgh Press ran a story with a headline they'd surely been sitting on for years. Death scores hit on retired numbers boss. Today, that once historic stretch of Wiley Avenue in the Hill District is empty. A vast plot of gravel that looks out on where the Civic Arena used to be. So this is hard to imagine, but try if you can. Gus Greenlee's chauffeured car crawls down the 1400 block of Wiley and stops in front of the Crawford Grill. The enormous red-headed man emerges, chomping on his cigar, and steps into the neighborhood called the Crossroads of the World, knowing he's the biggest thing in it. Thanks for listening to Nebby, and special thanks to my brother, Bobby Johnston, who suggested I write an episode about Gus Greenlee after he read Larry Tye's fabulous biography of Satchel Paige. If you have even a passing interest in baseball, you should definitely read it. For more information on the research or on the music used in this episode, check out the show notes or visit nebbypittsburgh.com. If you haven't rated or reviewed Nebby on iTunes, please consider it. It helps other people find the podcast. That's all for now, but I'll see you next month when Nebby returns with another story about Pittsburgh's history, mysteries, myths, and misanthropes.